This is not my drink every time I say cyber war talk. So before I begin, standard disclaimer. I am a Google engineer. I am not Google myself, et cetera, et cetera. The talk I'm giving today is called This Mess We're In, and it's about the changing state of the surveillance landscape and also sort of about, I think, what that means for security design decisions. So Katie gave me a great introduction. I'm a security engineer at Google, a researcher at the Citizen Lab, done volunteer work for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and so on and so forth. I'm going to sort of explain why you should be listening to me on the subject sort of first off. Like, I've actually done quite a lot of research on sort of surveillance, both mass and targeted, which I'm going to talk about just to give everyone an idea of sort of where we're at with surveillance and why it's actually evolved how it has. I'm going to talk a little bit about legal coercion, because that's actually been really pertinent in a lot of the recent news items and surveillance news that everyone has been discussing. And then, as I mentioned, I'm going to talk about the implications for security design. So I'm assuming everyone here is actually probably familiar with mass surveillance and massive intercept and the sort of concept of DPI, right? There's been a lot of talk about this type of technology for a really, really long time. As the majority of the communications that we perform sort of on a day-to-day and the sort of the commons that we use to communicate with each other became digital, obviously the profits from running this type of technology for surveillance purposes sort of has increased a lot. There's a variety of vendors that sell products which sort of facilitate this type of thing. One that you might have heard of is Narus. These guys sort of sprang to fame / infamy a few years ago when a man named Mark Klein, who was an AT&T technician, revealed that he was installing this gear for a fiber tapping room at AT&T in San Francisco. And Narus was the inspection provider that provided the big kit. And there's also sort of been implications that their gear has been found in, you know, various areas in the Middle East providing mass surveillance capability. You guys have probably seen this slide. This has been sort of, you know, this type of thing's been in the news a bit. This is X Key Score, which is allegedly the Five Eyes program for monitoring and collecting internet traffic for users. There's significant collection points all around the world, as you can see. As you also might expect from the best funded surveillance apparatus in the world. There's other companies that actually provide this type of capability as well. The editorializing of the blood, this is not their actual logo. This was not added by me. I found this on the internet. Amesis are a French DPI manufacturer. The reason why there is blood is because their gear was found in Libya, which led to a lot of headlines like this. So people were actually like fairly incensed about this and about the sort of real world implications of selling this type of gear in countries where rulish leadership could be described as repressive. There's other vendors. I mentioned Bluecoat. They're a vendor out of, I think, Sunnyvale, California. Now, I consider these guys to be a genuinely dual-use technology. I don't think that they're a bad actor or anything like that. They sell gear which can be used for basically sort of, you know, caching, proxying, real-time analysis of your network, traffic, that sort of stuff. They have, however, on occasion, gone to lawful intercept and surveillance fairs and actually pitched their gear as useful for lawful intercept purposes. So obviously this is sort of what I'd call genuinely dual use. There was some controversy about them that you guys might remember a few years ago. A hacktivist group called Telecomics found their gear in Syria. This is a big no-no for a variety of reasons. Syria is sort of one of the ultimately embargoed countries for US merchants, like along with Iran and Cuba and I think North Korea. So, you know, this was kind of a big deal. I think it was featured prominently in the Wall Street Journal and people got very worked up. There was later on allegations that I think their gear was being used in Saudi Arabia. Again, people got sort of very interested in this. I've got a Sorry, pardon me. Weird technical difficulties. So I was sort of interested in why people thought that, you know, it was found in... God darn it. Give me 1 second. Let's try this one more time. Okay. See, this is what I get for presenting from the cloud. I knew this would happen. Okie dokie. All right. So, again, there was rumors that this gear was being found in Saudi Arabia, and again, sort of people started getting worked up. And being a security engineer, I thought, wait, why are we pondering location of this type of technology in one country or another? Why don't we just map this everywhere? And so I sat down at the beginning of the year, and I decided that I would try to enumerate all the blue coat devices that I could see in the world, just to see. And so what you see here is the coloring of this might be a little misleading, but basically the black areas is where I did not find anything, which doesn't mean that there wasn't, it just means that I didn't find it. The gray areas are where this was found on networks that I did not care about. And I decided that I did not care because these were commercial networks. And the sort of the best practice for commercial networks is commonly to run them in as draconian a manner as possible. And so I decided that I was like, you know, I've run big network before. I've advised that people buy these types of devices. Just don't care. However, given that they actually pitch things like SSL intercept capability, right? Like, you get the sharp end of a dialog box, click choose file, insert magic key here. They don't provide it. Maybe you coerce a CA that's within your borders. Maybe you don't. Maybe you get a certificate from somewhere else. Who knows? But once you get your certificate, these offer SSL intercept capability, which is slightly worrying, I guess, from the perspective of someone who, you know, works for a company, you have a lot of users everywhere, and you sort of rely on SSL to protect them. So I was sort of interested in where this technology ends up. And so, you know, we found this stuff sort of all over the world, particularly interestingly in sort of countries like UAE, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and that sort of thing. So we published a paper on this. The New York Times reported on it in January, and what was kind of interesting was that a few months later, the government agency whose job it is to actually investigate technology sanction breaking and that type of thing, discovered that the reason why Blue Coat had ended up in Syria was that they had an unscrupulous reseller in the Middle East, and they were fined $2.8 million, which is actually kind of pocket change for the types of margins that they make, but it's still something. Now, I'm just going to leave it at that, but I'm not sure if you guys remember, do people remember the internet census when that came out? It's about like halfway through the year, these guys or girls, people unknown, wrote this botnet, and basically all it did was it scanned the internet, and it just kept breaking into hosts and then scanning from the perspective of those hosts. So we actually got visibility of the internet inside of networks that we'd previously not been able to see inside. I don't know, sort of like, it's like 8 terabytes of text or something. It's really big. But it's actually really fascinating. So myself and other colleagues from the Citizen Lab decided that we would reprise our efforts. And this was the result. All of a sudden, we found that this gear was inside Iran and Sudan and other places that we hadn't seen before. Iran is actually also a big no-no in one of being one of the ultimately embargoed countries that US vendors are not allowed to sell surveillance gear to. So this was reported on in July this year. The Washington Post stuck that on the front page, and investigation into this is still ongoing. We'll find out if they're gonna get fined again or what's going on there. So I do this just to sort of display the ubiquity of massive intercept gear. It's not a new concern though, right? Like, people have been really worried about this since the 90s. Justin Troutman earlier mentioned the kind of the cypherpunk dream, right? And I'd been talking with some friends, and we sort of posited this, like, what if someone, a 90s cypherpunk, you know, fell asleep in the 90s and woke up now? In some ways, it'd look like we were in a really great position. The world's largest operating system vendor ships with full disk crypto. The world's largest webmail providers use HTTPS. The Tor project still exists, and its usage is influencing world politics, right? Like, I mean, this is all really crazy. People are writing encrypted voice and encrypted text products. So, I mean, we won, didn't we? Maybe not. Then why are we sort of in this position that we're in at the moment? Well, as it turns out, like the surveillance landscape has sort of evolved a lot as has, you know, security technology, right? There was this fantastic article in Foreign Policy a little while ago on what they called the NSA's new code breakers, the Tailored Access Operations Division. And so what they actually said was that the majority of crypto these days was not broken using the NSA's much vaunted football field of mathematicians, but instead, what happened is that they had a squad of about 1,000 hackers, and they would just deploy these guys to break in and steal crypto keys, because this is significantly easier, right? And so Tal does just sort of targeted surveillance, sort of intrusion stuff. I mean, this is actually not the first nation state organization we've heard of that does this stuff. There's actually been extensive evidence of the Chinese government doing this type of thing for a really long time. There was, I think quite famously recently, the theft of key materials from RSA in order to facilitate the break-in to another military contractor, so on and so forth. As you might expect, this is not much different from hacking as we understand it. Exploitation of target, implant backdoor, exfiltrate whatever data, steal key materials, monitor communications, and profit. So this actually brings me to a very, very interesting blog post written by Microsoft last week, where Brad Smith said, indeed, government snooping potentially now constitutes an advanced persistent threat alongside sophisticated malware and cyber attacks. So Microsoft has a bunch of programs, which Katie talked about at length earlier, where they give people sort of heads ups about patching and vulnerabilities that's occurring. So sort of what occurs to me, as I imagine it has occurred to many people at Microsoft that work on this program, if you're giving an agent that you've dedicated as a bad actor, an advanced persistent threat, heads up about the bugs that you're going to kill, you're giving them heads up about the bugs that they're actually using to perform this type of surveillance. So I mean, I think this is sort of an example of how this actually interestingly changes the sort of relations between large corporates and governments that are actually exploiting this type of thing. Now, this is not a US thing, not just a China thing. This is an everyone thing. You guys might remember this. 3 years ago, it came out in legal discovery during a case where I believe the German police were prosecuting a steroid dealer, and they had to reveal how they'd gotten this information about him. And as it turned out, they'd installed a Trojan on his computer to gather information. The CCC actually managed to obtain a copy of the Trojan and actually did a great analysis and write-up of it. The Dutch government attempted to pass a law which would allow them to install malware on targets' computers, both within and outside their borders, and they wanted also it to be legal for them to delete undesirable content from these computers. Now, people actually thought this was too much. Like, this is too far. And so there was sort of significant protest against that law, and like it didn't pass in the form that it was initially proposed. So, you know, sort of talk a lot about malware, and I make this joke that, you know, this is any software which doesn't come with a EULA, right? but the thing is that in some ways, you know, a lot of the words that we've traditionally used to describe malware kind of put it into a different category than we should really be thinking about it, right? Because viruses were something that sort of happened and were kind of annoying and maybe you had to help out your neighbor with or something like that. Dimitri from CrowdStrike has a catchy phrase that he uses to this, which is like, you don't have a malware problem, you have an adversary problem. Malware isn't scary, being spied on by the government is scary, right? And over the years, I've actually worked with a bunch of sort of activists, journalists, and so forth that have actually been the targets of government surveillance in some interesting places. So the UAE Five were a bunch of five Emirati activists who were imprisoned in 2011 on charges of insulting the president and the royal family. This guy, Ahmed Mansour, was put in prison for signing a pro-democracy petition. He was released, but after his release, he suffered a variety of persecution, some of which was physical, and that he would show up to universities and people would, you know, come out of cars and beat him up and that sort of thing. Now, he actually managed, he suspected that his computer was backdoored. And so I actually, I looked at it for him. And what we actually found on the computer was this software, which is known as Remote Control System or DaVinci. This is their actual pitch on it. This is from the site. I didn't mock this up. And it's made by a Milan vendor called Hacking Team. And I mean, this is sold as a hacking suite for governmental interception. And so the idea is that this offers a surveillance solution for the sort of geographically mobile security aware target. right? And so, right, like, and so this type of solution is, like a lot of others of its kind, is theoretically only available for purchase by government intelligence or law enforcement agencies. The exploit that was used, it was theorized that this was actually a VPN exploit because they give a lot of talks back to back with Hacking Team, and there's sort of been materials which suggest that they use these exploits. However, you know, an article was published in Bloomberg about this in October 2012. VPN denied that, I think they said that they denied that they'd sold their exploit to the United Arab Emirates government. And Hacking Team interestingly said nothing, but then put up a page which said, if you're aware of any abuse of our product, please mail us at info@hackingteam.com. So another case of the sort of thing that I worked on was with a group of Bahraini activists. There's an NGO called Bahrain Watch, and a number of its members were targeted. This woman's name is Ala Shahabi. She's a British-born Bahraini activist. She's an economic lecturer in London. And she received an email. Who says user education doesn't work, right? She's non-technical, and it's like, I think I've been hit with a targeted Trojan. As it turns out, she was actually pretty on the money. I spent a bunch of time looking at this, and what actually sort of twigged my interest initially was I tried to run this in a sort of dynamic malware analysis sandbox, and it just disappeared. And I was like, oh, this is not crappy malware. And then sort of like further analysis revealed that it was packed, it crashed debuggers, it did all sorts of weird and interesting things. It specifically targeted antiviruses, it injected into antivirus processes and that sort of thing, which I was like, this is actually interesting. Like, what is this? And so it turned out that it was a piece of software known as FinFisher, or part of the FinFisher suite of intrusion tools known as FinSpy, which is their backdoor. This first gained notoriety during the Arab Spring. So when the revolution happened in Egypt, the Egyptians kicked down the doors of their state security apparatus, literally, and ransacked the offices. And within they actually found these papers. And these papers suggested the sale, or at least the negotiation, for the purchase of this intrusion solution. And as you can see, State Security Investigation Department, Cairo, Egypt, Remote Intrusions Solution, FinSpy. And you can see total is 287,000 euros, which might sound like some money, but is, in fact, dictator pocket change. So people actually got really interested in this when that happened, right? They were like, what is this FinSpy software? If we have never seen it, this is what Miko from F-Secure said about it. It's like, people were genuinely interested in figuring out what it was. So it turned out that this software was indeed it, because despite a lot of the sophistication of the anti-analysis methods, there were actually debug strings which revealed the path, developer path of the software in memory, which actually bore one of the directories was called like FinSpy v4.02. And so what does this stuff do? Well, it does all of the stuff that you would expect for malware that costs $300,000. You can record Skype calls, you can record audio, turn on people's webcams, record keystrokes, record VoIP calls, do all sorts of weird and wacky things. But you're not actually just buying a backdoor, right? What you're buying is you're buying a surveillance solution. People show up, they like give you training in this stuff, there's like a warranty, you can complain if stuff's not working. It works on all sorts of platforms. So I ended up analyzing all their mobile backdoors. This works on iOS, it works on Android, it works on BlackBerry, it works on Windows Mobile, it works on Symbian. Symbian, they support Symbian, right? Like, it's a discontinued cellular OS, and they support it because they're still users, right? And so, I guess this actually sort of shows precisely what you're getting when you buy this type of commercial intrusion kit. And the mobile spyware was actually, analyzing this was what actually freaked me out the most when I was doing all of this work. Because when you actually disassemble one of the mobile backdoors, in the actual code was something that was a function, it was a method called spy call. And what this actually did was it when it installed, it took control of the hardware, so you didn't see anything. Then it would make an outbound call to a remote number. And so your microphone would just remain on. And there was just this sort of constant listening device, your phone. And then it would activate call waiting. So if a phone came in, it would return control of the hardware. Your phone rings, you hit accept. The spy call goes into call waiting. You talk, you click, and then you know, remote microphone to somewhere. Which made me quite paranoid, and I was like, like it's like, you know, regular backdoors. I'm like, yeah, I understand. Wait, something that turns my phone into a remote listening device. So, I mean, this is what you get. Where is this stuff sold? Well, the answer is all over the world and frequently, right? So this is ISS World, which is commonly known as the Wiretapper's Ball. I mean, famously happens in DC, and I think the sort of some sort of reasonably well-known privacy griefers have gone along to troll it on occasion. But basically, intelligence support systems for lawful interception, criminal investigations, and intelligence gathering. This is a multi-billion dollar worldwide industry. It's not exclusively, this is simply like, this is like Black Hat, right? This is a branded trade show and conference. There's actually sort of multiple arms fairs around the world where this type of kit is sold. And so, as I mentioned before, I like mapping things. And so with a guy named Bill Marchak, Claudio Garnieri, and another guy called John Scott Relton, we did this. We spent a while like scanning the whole internet and got thrown off several service providers because it turns out that you pump out 18 billion packets or so and people get whingy. And we managed to sort of find C2s in all of the following countries. And I like to point out that existence of a C2 in a country doesn't mean that the country's using the software. Just means that the C2 is there. So for instance, the US, that's Amazon EC2, right? So I have no idea what country was using that, but half the world is on Amazon EC2. So what was the sort of impact of doing all of this research on that? Well, middle of last year, this got stuck on the front page of the New York Times, which means that a bunch of people started to care, particularly a group that are actually, I think, far crazier than hackers, which is investigative journalists, because they do all sorts of weird and crazy stuff to get information that sort of beyond the pale. And so they started sort of digging into this company, and it was found that they had, offshore accounts in the Cayman Islands and sort of skullduggerous business practices that I actually don't fully understand because it's not my area of expertise. And the British government actually decided that they weren't entirely sure that they were cool with this. And they were like, well, we should actually really review the sale of this type of technology to sort of monitor sort of where it goes a bit more stringently. Because the effects of this type of surveillance in countries that are actually in hot conflict can actually be really dire. So as everyone's probably aware, there's been sort of an extended period of unrest in Syria going from like January 2011. Shortly after the beginning of the physical conflict, we started seeing a digital campaign against opponents of the Syrian regime. So it was sort of around Christmas of 2011, a group of activists started receiving sort of targeted malware attacks. There was someone who was actually, his compatriots had been imprisoned, and he started receiving messages from them, and inviting him to install software that would actually keep him safe from the regime surveillance. So he did. And then he like sort of figured out that this was actually probably not really a good plan and realized that he actually needed serious help. And so, sort of a variety of people actually got involved, and I was one of them. And this sort of actually led to the sort of ongoing analysis and tracking of a campaign that exists to this day. The guy's face up on the screen, this man is Burhan Galyun. He's a professor at the Sorbonne in Paris, and he was for a while the leader of the Syrian Transnational Opposition. His Facebook page got hacked, and he ended up posting a piece of advice to the people that supported him, suggesting that they install this Facebook security software. Now, as you can tell, this is probably not legitimate. What was interesting is that While tracking the malware, I discovered the site that they'd been staging it on, and they didn't have directory. They had directory listing turned on, and so that meant that they'd actually made several mock-ups of this. Right, so there was this one which they toyed with, and then they were like, maybe this one. And so I show this because it's humorous, but a lot of this is actually really grim. Recently, I was looking at a campaign that was targeting an NGO that was assisting Syrians in the diaspora in Turkey. The lure was a video which showed the atrocities of the Assad regime. So I sat down, I was looking at this malware, and I pulled it apart, and I extracted the video from the implant and that sort of thing. And without thinking about it, I watched the video. Now, I was kind of in analysis brain, and I was sitting in a San Francisco office. And I've seen a lot of horrible things on the internet, but I said I wasn't really prepared for this. And the video did indeed show a soldier slitting the throat of this guy, letting him bleed out and dumping him into a shallow grave. Which is pretty grisly. So I sort of wanted to point out that this game is very real. The targets of targeted surveillance are obviously pretty well studied. And actually, the people who train targets to be secure are also well studied. there's been a raft of sort of backdoored circumvention tools, the types of tools that people like, suggesting to activists and dissidents and journalists and that type of thing. This is a tool that was supposed to help people avoid censorship in the Iranian internet. The left side is a legitimate installer for this program. The right side is an installer of a backdoored copy of it that talked to an IP address in Saudi Arabia. So obviously, if you're looking at content that you're not supposed to in Iran and someone is shipping your logs off, that's probably bad. This was a backdoored copy of Freegate, which is another sort of circumvention tool promising to evade censorship and surveillance. It installs an extra SVC host, which you probably don't want. I found a backdoored copy of Tor Browser Bundle, which was, the malware was obviously Chinese, and this is probably distributed amongst the sort of usual targets of Chinese government surveillance, possibly Tibet, Falun Gong, that sort of thing. So government surveillance is really depressing and scary. And it's been grim for a little while, so I thought that a handful of kittens might make him like, right? So I sort of break this up. All right, so the next bit is actually a little bit depressing as well. But as it turns out, that you actually don't necessarily need to do this if you're the right type of person and you're in the right geographical location, and so is your target, or the provider of the target. You can actually just ask for what you want. There's been a lot of discussion recently about the use of sort of secretive legal orders to compel people to do things. As you're aware, a lot of companies aren't allowed to publish even aggregate data about FISA orders. Microsoft and Google, I think, has legal action about this at the moment. And while the ability to use legal compulsion to force providers to cough up data isn't exactly new, the problem is it's not just raw data that they're coming for. There's been legal demands recently to alter systems, provide crypto keys, and that type of thing. There are probably people in this room that know the truth of this better than I, but I read recently in Mashable that Microsoft's BitLocker, which was launched in 2005, the lead engineer was repeatedly approached by the FBI to provide some sort of backdoor in the system or somehow coerce a security mechanism to provide access for law enforcement. Lavabit, which I'm sure everyone in this room has heard of, was Edward Snowden's mail provider. The government went to them for their encryption keys. They had not implemented forward secrecy, and so handing over these keys would mean that all mail, past and future, was able to be read. So they actually shut down in protest of this. There's a variety of legal battles that are trying to change this sort of thing. The EFF's been suing the NSA for a really long time. I helped co-author and sign a letter from the members of the security community to the NSA review board with recommendations that we had for them. It probably won't do anything, but that's actually writing these sorts of things is not really my area of expertise. I'm a security engineer. And so I've been thinking a bit about the implications of these revelations and sort of our increasing knowledge of surveillance towards security engineering specifically. And so I start from the axiom, which is as your web service increases in popularity, the likelihood that you will eventually be forced to coerce your security model approaches one. right? And now I thought that this might be a hard sell, and so I thought that I might have to explain it further. And then 3-4 days ago, right, this came out, and I was like, well, if this isn't sort of compelling, in the 82-page leaked document, there was this, written by the NSA, in a kind of like, the GCHQ has a vigorous effort to exploit game and virtual environments, and they have produced exploitation modules in Xbox Live and World of Warcraft, with the kind of tone like, this is thoroughly good, we've got to get in on this, right? Just like, okay, I think this is generally demonstrative of the point, which is sort of, if you have the user base, they will come, all right? And so there's sort of like a bunch of things that we've known how to do for actually a while. A lot of stuff isn't that crazy. However, historically when you've talked about them, you kind of sound like, you know, that crazy crypto guy. It's like, well, you know, we could really do these crazy things. You can split keys and, you know, have containers that are deniable. And, you know, you end up sort of sounding like someone who people don't necessarily listen to in large enterprise security. However, I'd like to demonstrate that a lot of these are actually not necessarily just good ideas, but are actually really practical and actually utilized at the core of the internet. For instance, split key storage, right? DNSSEC, the root key is split between 7 people because when this protocol was designed, they actually decided that designing coercion resistance into it was a really good idea. So you need 5 out of 7 key holders to actually show up to restart the DNSSEC system. I'm sure you guys, how aware are people of what forward secrecy is? People have talked about it quite a lot recently. And so forward secrecy is basically a mechanism by which you make sure that each cryptographic session is encrypted with a unique random key. So the compromise of any single session won't mean that, you know, sort of previously captured conversations are actually readable and so forth. It would have protected LavaBits users. So do you guys remember how in the kind of late 2000s, there was this sort of rallying cry for implementing HTTPS on all the sort of popular web properties, right? Gmail did it, I think so Hotmail did it, and, you know, Facebook and Twitter, and, you know, everyone was like, yay, we encrypted the internet, and much rejoicing. Unfortunately, this was premature, and I'm not actually talking about this, which you guys are probably aware of. Which actually kind of felt a little bit more like this at the time if you walked internally. I know this diagram is kind of complicated. A lot of people have problems with the Hodor Akbar RPC, which exists inside Google's network. But I'm actually talking about this, which is a diagram that a lot of you are probably very familiar with, right? There's, you know, Alice sends encrypted messages to Bob. Eve, the malicious eavesdropper, sits in between on the network. Now, the problem is that we actually encrypted Alice to Cloud 1 and Bob to Cloud 2, but we didn't actually encrypt anything in between. And so when a lot of these revelations came out, what actually rang through my head is that if you possess massive intercept capability, all of this stuff going between Cloud 1 and Cloud 2 is essentially free, right? Like, this email is clear text, and if you possess massive intercept, then you get it. And email is, you know, the money communication, right? Like, this is sweet. You don't even have to do tricky stuff involving exploitation and, you know, analysis-resistant malware. You just snarf it up. So, you know, it would actually be really good if we encrypted all of this data, so we weren't giving it away for free. So, you know, we actually sort of raised the cost of surveillance generally. And so there's a lot of stuff that's actually a really good idea. Certificate pinning and HTS, which I'm actually going to talk about in a little bit. But what would actually solve the specific problem that we're talking about earlier is something called StartTLS. And that already exists, right? StartTLS provides opportunistic mail crypto, because there's been a lot of discussion today by cryptographers who are smarter than I am about the problems that users have encrypting things. And what we actually want to do when we want to protect these sort of massive bodies of mail and user data that are just sort of floating across the internet is we want users to not have to do anything. And we should be protecting them, right? And so StartTLS actually provides that. What it means is that, you know, when someone sends a mail to a domain and they say hello, and the mail daemon, you know, broadcasts the capabilities they have, if they support StartTLS, the remote client can opportunistically encrypt mail to the certificate on the server, and it will go across the internet, not in the clear. And that would actually be really great. So I sat down when these revelations started to come out, and I looked through my inbox for the 20 mail domains that had sent me the most mail ever. Only 5 of them performed StartTLS, and only 2 of them actually did it properly. Which was, I was kind of like, you know, this would be really great. This stuff kind of already exists, but we're not using it. Things are actually better today. The last time I looked was November 7th, a month ago, that I really went through. But we still have big problems. But in terms of percentages, I looked online recently. I do not have exact numbers. This is not, you know, ground truth. But big three mail providers, Microsoft's mail offering, Yahoo Mail, and Gmail, which together account for more than 1 billion users. Now, wouldn't it be great if, in the short term, we could actually get all the major mail providers to run Start TLS with forward secrecy? And the good thing with this is that it already exists, it's doable, and it kind of fixes the Dragnet surveillance problem, right? And that it means that, as opposed to passive sniffing, you would actually have to go targeted in order to steal these communications. The bad thing here would be that targeted attacks are obviously still very possible, because you just intercept the connection and say, I don't support this anymore, and bam, mail happens in clear text. Longer term, what I would really like to see is all the major providers adopt Start TLS with certificate pinning. The bad thing is that this is trickier and requires sort of real engineering. The good thing is that this provides real protection for over 1 billion users. It would protect against mass surveillance, and it would significantly raise the bar for targeted man in the middle of user data in transit. And so I think that engineering against the coercion of our security model is actually something that we actually have to do now in order to protect our users, and something that we actually have to take into account if we actually claim to be security engineering properly. And as it transpires, we actually have the tools, and I think we can do this. So despite all this stuff being really scary, I would say that, you know, we shouldn't be security nihilists, and I think this is actually, some of this is quite doable. So yeah. I had conspirators and help with doing all of this research. I'd like to thank people. And do people have questions? Don't be shy, right? I got a sample question to get people started if they, you know, like. This does happen frequently after these sorts of talks.
Hello.
Yep. Okay. So adding crypto is one valuable layer. Are there other things that a big company like Microsoft should be thinking about in terms of better protecting our customers in these various places?
Well, as I mentioned before, giving certain areas of the government significantly advanced warning that you're going to kill their bugs is also probably a thing that you may want to reconsider. Now, I don't actually understand this game nearly as well as Katie, who gave a talk about this earlier. So, but it's actually more one of those things that I sort of suggest that that discussion should happen, right? Like, so.
Suggestion noted, yes.
Anyone else? Oh, it's over.
More of a comment than a question. In regards to the opportunistic encryption and the Start TLS, we already do that by default out of the box with the Exchange server.
Who's we?
We is Microsoft.
Ah.
Yeah, so our product, Exchange server, default installation, TLS is enabled. Now, it doesn't often get set up properly by customers, and that is actually something that I personally am working on with our premier customers today. And then with what was Hotmail or is now, you know, Office 365 and Outlook.com, we do TLS with that as well. I'm curious, so I guess there is a question with this too. I'm curious as to what providers you found we were not doing that between.
So we should talk more about this offline, but you actually don't broadcast. So for your webmail offering, I mean, so, and also the fact that you are working on a product which provides Start TLS out of the box is fantastic, so thank you, that's great. But the webmail offering, where you have hundreds of millions of users, doesn't actually broadcast Start TLS capability on inbound. I know that you actually do opportunistically encrypt when you send to providers that support that capability, but not going mail going into your MXs. So, I mean, maybe that's something that you're changing at the moment, but last time I checked, which was very recently, you don't.
Okay, so you found it on outbound only then?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Anyone else?
Bo.
I'm curious as to whether there's a like kind of a well thought out process procedure tool suite for some of the people who may be trying to evade surveillance in places like Syria, Libya, et cetera, et cetera.
So I mean, not all places where people are trying to evade surveillance are the same. Obviously, it depends on, you know, your threat model, who the obviously your concerns if you are trying to evade the Syrian government and you live in Turkey are different than if you want to evade the Syrian government and you live in the UK, and are also very different to someone's concerns if they want to evade, say, the Five Eyes. I think that the problem, Syria is a very interesting case because a lot of software there is pirated because companies aren't allowed to sell stuff. I think that, you know, in order to avoid sort of the type of mass surveillance that we've been discussing, Tor browser is pretty easy to use, provides the capability of Tor. People use VPNs a lot, that type of thing. I mean, I think there's probably sort of a stack of stuff, but I hesitate to offer sort of general panacea advice. However, if you have specific cases in mind, I'm happy to chat to you about it afterwards. Okay, anyone else? Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay, this will be the last question.
I have a legal question for you about the US.
Okay, not a lawyer, but.
Yeah, sure. But do you know what the law says about the government gathering data? Can, for example, if the government wants to gather data from companies such as Google or Microsoft, is it allowed for them to give the information for free? Or, I mean, what are the laws about that?
I would actually open this one up to the floor if there's anyone that actually knows the answer for definite on this one. Because I said I'm actually not a lawyer, so I'm kind of hesitant to, you know. I'm really not sure what laws govern that. And I think it probably depends on the type of data and the agency and that sort of thing. But I'm sorry, I don't know.